Bonsoir, mesdames et messieurs. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the National Interest Forum at the University of Toronto. My name is Daryl Dular. I'm managing director of CNIC, Canada's National Interest Council, and coordinator for the National Interest Forum. A few words about the sponsoring organization. CNIC was established in 1994 as an independent association of individuals functioning as a nonprofit, nonpartisan public interest organization. Our purpose is to develop better ways to engage the public on issues of national concern. So we have a whole spectrum of things that we try to address. Previously, we produced the Democracy Forum series for the now-dissolved Council of Canadians of Greater Toronto. That was the founding chapter. We have co-sponsored a variety of conferences with such organizations as the Alliance of Seniors, the Center for Social Justice, the Committee on Monetary and Economic Reform, and the St. Lawrence Center Forum. This particular series, the National Interest Forum at U of T, started in September of 1998, and we continue to do this sort of free programming as our budgets allow. Speakers in this current series have included the following authors. You may have caught some of them. University of Guelph philosopher John McMurtry, author of Unequal Freedoms and the Cancer Stage of Capitalism. Former Toronto Mayor John Sewell, author of a number of books, including The Shape of the City. Economics historian William Crame, Meltdown and A Power Unto Itself, the Bank of Canada. Social policy analyst Armin Yelnitsian, The Growing Gap, and a brand new book that we have out there, Canada's Great Divide. OISE's Chair of Sociology and Equity Studies, David Livingston, The Education Jobs Gap. Former Deputy Prime Minister of Canada, Paul Hellyer, Funny Money and Evil Empire. A University of Toronto Professor of Psychiatry, Morton Beiser, Strangers at the Gate. This addressed the immigration issues in the country. And last month, York University sociologist Janice Newson, co-author of The University Means Business and Universities and Globalization. Tonight, of course, we're very honored to have Naomi Klein. Next month, we're equally honored to have Ottawa lawyer and founder, co-founder of Democracy Watch, Aaron Freeman, with his just now being published book, Cashing In, Money and Influence in Canadian Politics. It's a real expose. About our speaker this evening, Naomi Klein is a former editor for This Magazine and former editor-at-large for Saturday Night. She's been nominated for four National Magazine Awards and has appeared in numerous publications. Her articles have appeared in numerous publications, including The Globe and Mail, with whom she's about to start a new column on the op-ed pages. She's also appeared in the New York Times, The Village Voice, Ms., Elm Street, The Baffler, and Toronto Life. Currently, her book, No Logo, is an international bestseller. The Economist magazine advised that, and I quote, No Logo should be read by anyone who thinks that last year's Seattle demonstrations were an aberration, unquote. Without further ado, please welcome very warmly our speaker this evening, Ms. Naomi Klein.
Thank you, Daryl. And I'd like to thank CNIC for organizing this event. I wrote this book because I started to notice something a few years back, about 5 years ago. It was a shift in activist focus, sort of broadly defined. More and more, I started noticing that people concerned with social justice, with environmentalism, with human rights, were taking direct aim at corporations more and more, as opposed to going after governments directly. There were all kinds of pockets of anti-corporate activism emerging. There was a rise in Canada of culture jamming, ad busting, the tactics of sort of parodying advertising and using the tactics of marketing against itself. Then there were a few sort of simultaneous campaigns that were targeting multinational corporations like Shell Oil for its actions in Nigeria, or Monsanto and Cargill for its activities in India, for instance. There was the McLibel trial in England, which went after McDonald's, decided to sue two British environmentalists for libel. There was the Nike campaign over sweatshop labor. I'm going to come back to these cases in more detail later on. But what I want to say first off is that these activists were not abandoning traditional tactics and demands for government regulation of corporations, for full funding of public institutions, for instance. It's just that they were finding that they were having better luck affecting change by going after corporations rather than governments directly, and that in some ways that was starting to make sense. This was happening at a time when the left itself was paralyzed by the inability to affect change through traditional political means. I think we felt that particularly keenly in Ontario after the Ray government. And this shift seemed to make sense, that at a time when everyone was talking about corporations ruling the world, of course activists would shift their focus to take better aim at these new rulers. But when I started doing this research 5 years ago, these were only little pockets, atomized, not connected to one another in any way. But as I began to track this movement for the book, what I started to see was a movement emerging before my eyes. The anti-World Trade Organization protests in Seattle, I believe, were this movement's North American coming out party. In Seattle, the pockets of resistance came together. And I think we're going to see this convergence again in Washington on April 16th and 17th during the anti-World Bank and IMF protests. In all of these campaigns, something very simple that at this point seems self-evident was happening, that the multinational corporation was being identified as the root cause of the degradation of labor standards, human rights, and environmental standards around the world. And global institutions, the World Bank, the IMF, APEC, the WTO, were being identified as the vehicles to advance that agenda. And now, of course, we're seeing the signs all over. McGill students just voting down a deal with Coca-Cola at their school that would have given the company exclusive vending rights and marketing rights on their campus. This week, Concordia students, actually the referendum ends today, are holding a referendum about whether or not they want to have ads on their campus, particularly in washrooms. At the University of Toronto, students occupied the president of the university's office for almost 2 weeks, just until a few days ago, in fact, demanding that the University of Toronto adopt a code of conduct that it would apply to the companies that produce the garments that bear the U of T name. This month, as well, at the University of Montreal, Tom Ingersoll, a tenured history professor, resigned in protest of the growing corporate influence on his campus. This is all within a matter of weeks. Only 5 years ago, these issues, exclusive vending deals by companies like Coke and Pepsi, ads on campuses, even sweatshop labor itself, were all but invisible. The question I want to try to answer today is why now? Because, of course, these issues aren't new. Corporate complicity with labor, environmental, and human rights abuses is not new. And corporations have always been the engines of deregulation. Why then are these issues forming the backbone of what seems to be the next major political movement? Why are they drawing people to the streets in the thousands? I believe that one of the answers has to do with an ideology that has gripped the corporate world in the past 15 years and has sent it into euphoric convulsions in the age of e-commerce. And that idea is that in order to be a successful corporation in the global age, you need to produce brands, not products. The idea is that anyone can produce a good product, that competing based on the relative value of your product, of your machine, of your pair of jeans, of your cola, is essentially a loser's game. And as evidence, the proponents of this theory say, look at IBM. Look at what happened to IBM when it almost went under in the late 80s and early 90s, because IBM was selling machines, and then the market was flooded with virtually identical PC clones, and IBM almost lost out entirely. Now if we look at IBM, you wouldn't even know that the M stands for machines. IBM is about solutions. IBM is about ideas. IBM is about the idea of globalization itself. It is pure brand. And it doesn't say our computers are better than our competitors, because they know that that's ridiculous. You can go on the internet and you can make your own computer and have it delivered. They say, believe in our brand, believe in our story. In this context of hostility towards products, the brand has evolved from its original incarnation as a mark of quality on a product, to differentiate one product from another in a post-industrial age, to becoming a badge of courage for the consumer. What's changed is who and what is branded, because, of course, in the old formula, it was the product that was branded with the Aunt Jemima logo or the Quaker Oats or the Campbell logo or the Levi's logo. Now it is we who are branded with the Tommy Hilfiger logos with the Nike swoosh tattoos. Last week, the U.S. Supreme Court made a very interesting decision. They ruled that knockoffs of designer clothing, clothing that exactly imitates the style and pattern of well-known designers, did not constitute a trademark or copyright infringement. The only infringement, they ruled, is if another company produces a confusion in the marketplace by imitating the actual logo. What they were saying was, this was an incredible admission by the Supreme Court, that in a brand-driven economy, the brand has little to do with the product or the design, that in fact these are incidental. You can go ahead and copy each other's products at will. Rather, the brand is what is of value, the freestanding idea, the mythology, the story. The goal of these successful brands is nothing short of transcendence from the world of products, from the world of things. It's a very spiritual quest. But for this to work, corporations first need to find their souls. They first need to decide what their idea is, what their story is. So in this context, in the past 10 years, we've been treated to a wave of corporate epiphanies. We've heard from Nike, for instance, that they are no longer a shoe company. They are about the idea of transcendence through sports. We heard from Starbucks, we are not a coffee company. We are about community. We are about the idea of the third place, which is not home, not work, but rather a place where people gather as citizens, kind of like this, only a little bit different. We heard from Diesel Jeans that no, they weren't about jeans. They were, in fact, about a movement. They were creating a movement. We heard from Microsoft that they weren't about software, but rather the idea of freedom and communication. Where do you want to go today? We heard from Martha Stewart that she was about old-time family nurturing. We heard from Restoration Hardware that they were just about old-time money. The product becomes, in this context, almost an accessory, a medium to express the brand idea, the story, a prop. It is one medium among others, sort of like a billboard. Now, this is the Nike paradigm. Put all of your money in your window, like Honest Ed's. Put all of your money into your story. And, of course, Nike doesn't own any of its factories and was always run as an import-export scheme. This has proved enormously profitable. Nike went from a multi-million dollar company after it had its branding epiphany to being a multi-billion dollar company. Between 1995 and 1997, Nike's investors reaped a 320% increase in stock price. But of course, the Nikes and the Starbucks and the Levi's and the IBMs, no matter how much they invest in their spiritual selves, no matter how much they try to transcend their earthly goods, sell off their factories, don't make them themselves, and I'll come back to that later. Of course, they are still in some ways weighed down by the fact that fundamentally they are still selling things, the coffee, the jeans, the sneakers. So where we're really seeing the logical conclusion of this ideology is with the dot-com companies, the IPOs, the Netscapes and the Amazon.coms and the Yahoos. This is where the ultimate transcendence is taking place, where we have companies that are enormously wealthy, but it's quite mysterious what it is that they're selling, or what their products are, what their services are. In fact, not only have they transcended products entirely, but they have even transcended profits. It's tempting to dismiss this branding mania as flavor of the week management babble, a balloon economy, and I'll come back to that later. But what I'm arguing is that this seemingly innocuous kind of flaky idea is having three major transformative effects on our culture, which taken together go very far towards explaining the rise of anti-corporate activism. And I'll separate these three transformative effects into three categories: no space, no choice, and no logo. No jobs, sorry. The first is no space. When you decide that you are about an idea, once you have identified your corporate soul, what you need to do is you need not just to be a story, but you need to tell your story. In other words, you need to project your brand idea, your brand image, your lifestyle onto as many cultural surfaces as possible. That's how you become real. That's how you become an enormously profitable idea that is freed from the world of products. How do you do this? You do this through the sponsorship of cultural events, of sporting events. You do it by launching your own lifestyle magazine where consumers are able to see the product in action. Are they able to see the stars of Dawson Creek rowing down some New England landscape in J. Crew clothes, for instance? That's what it's all about. Or building a three-dimensional brand mecca, a superstore, where customers are able to experience the brand as a kind of theater, where the music and the art and the design all come together to express the brand meaning, tell the story. Most of all, you need fresh new surfaces to express the brand idea. What branding is about is a response to our cluttered culture. We're not the only ones as citizens who feel the cluttering of our landscape. Of course, the people who feel it most keenly are the brands themselves, because, of course, their goal is to get their message out there. But everybody else is doing the same thing. So what they have to do is they have to find kind of pure virgin spaces. Picture a kind of a wall of hoardings. That's a lousy place to put up a poster. It just gets lost. So what you need is you need fresh space. Conveniently enough, this branding ideology has taken root at the same time as our public institutions have been underfunded by government and have gone looking for new sources of funding. So, of course, our schools, our libraries, our public spaces, our public festivals have come along to provide fresh space, virgin space for the brands. The fresher the space, the more absorbent it is to the brand story. If you think of the brand economy as a balloon, and certainly the IPO economy is called a balloon quite often, if you think of it as a balloon because there is so little that is solid in the middle, then this process of absorbing cultural space, public space, building the experiential shopping extravaganzas is how it staves off its own deflation. It's how it becomes real. Advertising agencies more and more think of themselves as factories, because they are now producing all that is driving our branding economy. In fact, there's an advertising agency in Toronto called the Brand Factory, and this makes a lot of sense, because these are the new producers of our age. We have the brand managers who help companies, they're sort of the handmaidens of this soul searching, help the companies find their corporate souls. We have the brand factories who help the companies project that image out there into the culture. But of course, the other arm of this equation are the cool hunters who help the brands decide what their brand meaning will be. Because of course, they need to come up with a story, come up with an idea that is guaranteed to resonate. That is guaranteed to resonate in particular with young people, because that is the demographic that most consumer brands are after. So we have a new industry that didn't exist before 1993, which is called the cool hunting industry. And it is there to go into the back alleys and the playing fields and the clubs and the schools and rifle through the closets of our youth and come back to the brands like Coke and Pepsi and Reebok and say, young people are really concerned about corporate responsibility these days. Is there any way we can work with that? There's a difference between this process that I'm describing, branding and advertising. When I started writing this book, I didn't realize that there was a difference. I thought branding was just kind of stepped up advertising. What I've come to understand is that this is a radically different process, that advertising is about association. It's about associating a product with a lifestyle, with an image, with an ideal. What branding is about is full-on merger. It's about integration. So it isn't about associating one's brand with music, but incarnating one's brand, equating one's brand with the music industry. So rather than tagging the logo on, as previous sponsors of the music industry would have done, you have Tommy Hilfiger, which has succeeded in essentially integrating himself, becoming a rock star, the brand as rock star. And that's what this process is about, making brands into pop culture, occupying the same space as celebrities, as artists, as sports heroes. So Nike, who told us with such enthusiasm that it was a sports company, didn't stop at that. What they started to do was started to buy out sporting events outright, golfing tournaments. So they became sports. They began the integration process with the culture. My favorite example is Roots Canada, because Roots, as I'm sure many Canadians know, is a company that was started by a couple of guys from Detroit who went to summer camp in the Canadian wilderness, and they liked it so much that they started a clothing company whose brand association was the Canadian wilderness and summer camp. They did everything they could to associate their brand with these ideas. But today, of course, that is not what they're doing. They're integrating. They're into integration. So not only are they branding the Olympics and sort of creating a merger between that logo and their logo, but I had the opportunity to visit the Roots Lodge on the west coast of Vancouver Island about a year ago, which is a Roots summer camp. So they've come full circle from associating themselves with summer camp to actually building a brand cocoon that is summer camp. Deep in the beautiful Canadian wilderness, everything is Roots. The pillowcases, the bath mats, the cutlery, and your neighbor is Ross Trevelyan, and it only costs $350 a night. Swatch has launched Internet Time, transcends time zones. Benetton, of course, has decided that it will be a political campaigner. It will occupy the same cultural space as political movements. It will campaign for death row inmates, a very problematic issue, which I hope we can talk about a bit more in the question and answer period. The goals of branding is this kind of seamless integration. What we're seeing is a new culture, a third culture, that is an integration between public and private space. In this new culture, the brand is the infrastructure. The culture is the brand content. I think within this context, a kind of global claustrophobia begins to set in, the idea that there's no escape. Cool hunting, after all, is a form of legalized mass stalking. And more students themselves are being enlisted as self-promoters because, of course, what the cool hunters are telling the brands is that young people are suspicious of big corporations. So the only way to get around this is to get young people working for you. In the States now, on university campuses, students are selling each other textbooks through Varsity Books. They're selling each other Daewoo cars, all kinds of magazine subscriptions. There's a new breed of marketer called a cyber informant, where you're paid by brands to promote certain products on the internet, but of course nobody knows that you're being paid. Students in high schools are being given disposable cameras and diaries to take home and fill up with all of their thoughts and dreams and hand over to market researchers in their schools to videotape each other's haircuts, survey their favorite CD covers, keep track of the current lingo. So we have a kind of sort of spy versus spy youth culture. And I think that why this matters is that it matters for the creation of new ideas, for new scenes, because what this means is that there's no longer any gestation period when a new idea or a new artistic movement can emerge, and the people who are doing it could possibly be naive enough to have the illusion that nobody is watching. I believe that what all young people know on a certain level today is that there is nothing more profitable, nothing more sought after than the commodity of youth and cool. So faced with this, you have a couple of options. One of them is that you turn yourself into a commodity. You embrace this. You say, great, I have what everybody wants. You turn yourself into what Tom Peters calls a brand called you. You become a professional consumer. That's one route, and it's a very profitable route. But the other thing you might do is you might begin to run in the opposite direction. I want to talk about the second effect, which I'll call no choice. The true goal of this type of lifestyle branding, the ultimate goal, is to be the lifestyle, to be the self-enclosed brand cocoon. The best way to achieve that, most companies, of course, can't just do that overnight. The best way to do that is to merge with another company, maybe a few other companies. When we hear about these mergers, it's usually just sort of surface-level rhetoric. You've got to be big to compete in the global economy, but it's about more than that. If you look at AOL and Time Warner, BCE and CTV, it's the fact that merged companies are the ones that are best positioned to be lean, mean brand machines, to express their brand idea, to tell their story through as many different mediums simultaneously as possible, to have true integration. There are many words for this process. There's synergy, there's partnerships, there's convergence, there's bundling. The end point, I believe, is Celebration Florida, which is the Disney-owned town in Florida where everything is private, the school, the streets. But there's something very interesting about Celebration Florida, and that's that in Celebration Florida there are no ads. It is the first truly branded community, fully branded community in America, and I believe it is the only brand-free community in North America. There are no billboards, no franchise outlets. And Disney says that this is because they have a profound reverence for public space, that they wanted their ideal community to of course, harken back to their brand image, which is the bygone American town. And there's a little of that, no doubt. But I think that there's something deeper, of course, which is that when you reach your brand nirvana, when you finally get there after all the mergers and all the brand extensions and the experiential shopping and the cruise ships and the theme parks, what you want to do is you want to block out the competition. And the reason why that matters is because it shows that what's good for branding is, in fact, terrible for consumer choice. That these brand cocoons are precisely about the elimination of choice. That's what this brand cohesion is about. The best example of this is Microsoft and what we found out through the antitrust suit. Because the urge to build their self-enclosed brand cocoon was, in fact, the same as the urge to build a monopoly. And, of course, this was particularly stark when it came to Microsoft, because Microsoft was one of the key companies that sold so many of us on the promise of the information age, of increased choice, of increased interactivity. So what the antitrust suit represented was more than just one company getting caught with its pants down. What it meant was a public betrayal of the information age. So once again, we are engulfed in brands. No space, no choice. The third effect, no jobs, I believe is the most distressing one of the effects of the branding economy. I've said that branding is about transcending products. But what does that actually mean? It means that products, more specifically the people who produce them, because there's no sign that we're stopping to consume them, have just gotten a big demotion in the economic hierarchy. Because, of course, in this context, products are now banal, and branding is what's exciting. But branding is enormously expensive. Building the superstores, the theme parks, the cruise ships, the towns, this is not advertising, it's culture building, and the money needs to be saved from somewhere. Where it is being saved is from production. So you have companies that only a few years ago were satisfied with 100% markup from what it would cost to produce, for instance, a Nike shoe to what it would cost to sell it, now demanding a minimum of a 400% markup. The way to achieve this type of markup is to let somebody else produce your product for you, and then you buy that product. You no longer are a producer. You are a quote-unquote sourcer. You source your own product as if it were a raw commodity, whether it's jeans or coffee or computers. Better yet, what you do is you get lots and lots and lots of companies to produce your product for you, contractors and subcontractors and maybe some home workers, and you get them to compete against each other, spread over the entire globe, for who can offer you the best price. And that's how we get the race to the bottom. This, of course, is the Nike paradigm that everyone else has jumped on. Intel, Motorola, Adidas. Timberland, I just came across this statistic recently, and I think it's quite dramatic, that 5 years ago, Timberland owned 80% of the shoes that it that it sold. It owned 80% of its own production, its own factories. Now it's down to 18%, and it's still trying to get that lower. Adidas has managed just in the same time frame to sell off all of its European factories. But those factories are not reopening. They're becoming contracts to be placed with subcontractors. This is where the free trade zones come in. $250 billion worth of trade flows through the free trade zones, often called maquiladoras or export processing zones. And we've all heard the horror stories, I believe, coming out of Mexico, Indonesia, Honduras, the 12 and 16-hour days, the salaries that pay enough for perhaps two meals a day, but certainly not three, the forced overtime, cramped dorm rooms. Usually when we talk about the rise of sweatshop laborers, and I think that the American labor movement has to own up to this fact, because it's always couched in, you know, they're stealing our jobs. It's about where it's produced, not how it's produced. It's important for us to recognize with each new study that comes out that these are not anomalies. And this is not really about where the product is produced, whether it's in China or Indonesia or right here in Toronto. These are not anomalies. These are the byproducts, the logical conclusions of the branding economy, of the degradation of product in our economy. And so we might clean it up a little bit, but the basic structure remains the same, that work is being degraded by the obsession with marketing. When I was in the Philippines researching export processing zones, I had the opportunity to interview the man who is the government-appointed politician to head up the largest free trade zone in the Philippines, a guy named Raymundo Negrampa. And I asked him about the conditions inside the zone. And he said, you know, he didn't deny any of it. He didn't deny that there's Filipino labor laws were being flouted right, left, and center, that unions were being busted, even though supposedly, according to Filipino law, workers had the right to organize. He didn't deny any of that. What he said to me was, you know what, you shouldn't worry so much, because these are just young women. He said, you know, they're 18, 19, 20, maybe 25. They're just trying to earn a little extra money to send back to their families who are living in the countryside. They're migrants. They're not supporting families. They're living in dorms. And it's temporary. It's temporary. As I was listening to this, I was reminded of when I was writing a story, actually for this magazine, about 7 years ago, about a group of young women, 18, 19, 20 years old, who decided to unionize their clothing store in Mississauga. It was a clothing chain called Limité. And the company tried to bust that union for everything it was worth. And I interviewed the head of that company. And he said to me, you know, Naomi, you shouldn't worry so much, because these are just young women. They're just trying to earn a little bit of extra money to put themselves through school, maybe help their families out a little bit. These aren't real jobs. Essentially, they're jobs with training wheels. They're what we've come to understand as MIC jobs. It's obscene to compare the conditions of workers at the North American mall to workers in the Latin American and Asian sweatshops. They're not comparable. But from the perspective of the companies, of the super brands, there's an undeniable symmetry at work. Because there, in many cases, these are the same companies, the Gap, Nike, Walmart, Starbucks, McDonald's, who are pioneering a new kind of work, a work that doesn't really matter, disposable temporary work. And just as they have convinced us here that these jobs don't really matter, that they're kind of joke jobs for kids, so have they done a remarkably similar things, the Gaps, the Walmarts, the Levi's, in the developing world. Factory jobs as MIC jobs. But of course, this phenomenon is not just about MIC jobs. It's not just about contract workers. Whenever you talk about sweatshops or you talk about MIC jobs, you know, people sort of look at you like, well, it's just because you don't understand the new economy. These are old economy jobs, and Bill Gates is going to save us. That's the answer to all of this. But of course, it's interesting because there was a time when it looked as if Bill Gates was going to save us, when he was minting millionaires right, left, and center. Right now, Microsoft keeps between 4,000 and 6,000 of its workers at its headquarters in Washington State, classified as temps, or rather, what they call themselves is perma temps, because so many of them have been there for so long, couple of years, in many cases, or more, that there's no difference between the Microsoft permatemps and the Microsoft millionaires, the permanent employees with the stock options. Microsoft has, in the past decade, been finding more and more departments to outsource, from its mailroom to its company store. In fact, Microsoft has outsourced so many of its departments that it had to hire an outside company to manage all of its temp, all of its outsourced departments, because, as they explained, that was not one of their core competencies. So what we're seeing is a class system develop. Daryl mentioned different speakers who've come here talking about the growing gap between rich and poor in Canada. And certainly we've heard a lot about that. We've heard a lot about the growing gap between first and third world within countries, but now also within companies themselves. These brands are the same brands that have been involved in the process of absorbing cultural space and consumer choice that I've been describing. These are the brands that are most actively entwined in our culture through marketing, now attempting to opt out of the economy in this most central way as employers. So you have this odd dichotomy of brands that are at once culturally omnipresent, trying desperately to develop these meaningful, quasi-spiritual relationships with us as consumers, at the same time as they're actively disengaging from us as employers. The effect of this, I believe, perhaps optimistically, you can tell me later, is that these brands are courting backlash, that there is nothing in the New Deal with workers as employers of temps, part-timers, and contractors that will protect them from public rage. Which brings us back to Seattle and what I believe was behind all that shattering glass. When you take no space, no choice, and no jobs together, you get what I call in the book No Logo, the rise of anti-corporate activism. I've mentioned a few of these campaigns targeting McDonald's, Monsanto, Microsoft, the anti-sweatshop campaign targeting Nike, the human rights and environmental campaigns targeting Shell Oil. People often make the mistake, I believe, of viewing these campaigns as mere consumer boycotts that are simply about promoting ethical consumption, just like the old kind of anti-corporate activism. I believe that is an underestimation of what this movement is really about, that these are, in fact, political campaigns that are using corporations as political tools to achieve political ends, that all over the world, citizens are fighting macro-political battles against sweatshops, against genetically modified foods, against human rights abuses, dictatorships, against monopoly, by focusing in on one or two large brand-name corporations. And what's interesting is that the best tool of these campaigns is, in fact, the logic of branding itself. We have become a culture of facades, and in a way, that culture begs to be shattered. Activists are creating sharp juxtapositions between production and brand image because it's a gimme. The Nike worker on a speaking tour, a Nike factory worker from Indonesia going to the Nike town on Fifth Avenue to see how much it costs to buy the shoes that she produced for $2 a day. The juxtaposition of Kathy Lee Gifford, the saccharine sweet TV mom, and the reality of child labor and producing of her line of clothing for Walmart. I mean, you just can't resist that. The Gap's image, everybody in khakis, Rage Against the Machines was using that in a video, everybody in denial with people hunched over sewing machines. The anti-genetic engineering campaigners from Europe developed this idea of Frankenfoods. They would go to the supermarket sort of dressed up in grotesque costumes of fish and potato fingers and things like that, kind of pelting the facade of the brand with the reality of production. The effectiveness of these tactics has to do with the arrogance of branding itself. The seeds of discontent are bred into its very DNA. Because once a company decides that its true product is its image, its brand, it becomes enormously vulnerable to these types of semiotic terror tactics. A corporate brand balloon, after all, is by its very nature filled with hot air. Seattle itself was kind of a citywide theater in this type of culture jamming. We saw police dressed in riot gear protecting Nike Town and Starbucks, French farmers handing out contraband cheese outside of McDonald's, labor activists hanging 500-foot anti-sweatshop banners on the side of Old Navy. A topless protester featured in Newsweek with "Better Naked Than Nike" scrawled on her back. But this is about much more than playing games with imagery. The rallying cry of the student anti-sweatshop movement in the U.S. and now in Canada has become disclosure. This seemingly innocuous idea is to demand that brands like Champion, Nike, JanSport provide schools with a list of all of the contractors that produce their goods. In an age when companies employ this web of contractors and subcontractors globally, this is a very serious demand. And companies responded by saying, no, that's a trade secret. We won't tell you where our goods are produced. That's how alienated the brands have become from their sites of production. It's a trade secret. On January 1st, faced with mounting student pressure, several companies did comply with this demand and produced lists, albeit limited lists, of their contractors. And I believe that this is more than a symbolic victory, because what it means is that students now have the tools to create direct lines of communications between the workers who produce their clothing with their school logos, their Nike sneakers, and students themselves. But also, this rallying cry of disclosure, on a very important level, chips away at the distance these companies have put between their brand image and their sites of production. In a sense, it pulls these transcendental corporations just a little bit closer to Earth, which is not where they want to be. I've also found that there is a very clear connection between the branding ambition of the company and the ones that are getting targeted. In a sense, the more inflated the brand balloon, the more likely it is that this expansion has bred armies of pin-wielding critics anxious to watch that balloon fall to the ground. Phil Knight said about 7 years ago, when the backlash against his company first started to take root, he said, somehow the emotions we create, sorry, Phil Knight is the CEO of Nike, he said, somehow the emotions we create imply their opposites. I think this is because, as a culture, we have deeply ambivalent relationships with the brands that have so aggressively enveloped our public spaces. The other reason is that these emotions that they create were, of course, not created out of thin air. They were borrowed from us. These ideas about community, rebellion, communication, the global village, these were our ideas to begin with. So, of course, we have ambivalent relationships. Of course, they imply their opposite. After this speech, we're going to hear from somebody from Students Against Sweatshops to give us a little bit of an update about what's happening at U of T. But I want to talk about this in the context of this movement that I've watched with amazement, because 3 years ago, there was no such thing as Students Against Sweatshops. Now there are over 200 chapters on schools across North America. Students are leading the fight against sweatshops. And what's interesting is that corporate logos are providing the infrastructure for this global movement. Where a previous generation was entreated to follow the money, this generation is following the logo. From their college sweatshirts to the sweatshops of Honduras, from the swooshes on their school gymnasium floors to the factories of Indonesia, from their Starbucks lattes to the sun-scorched fields of East Timor. Being a target market for every powerful brand on the planet, being cool-hunted and brand-managed and cyber-stalked, means having a direct personal connection to other people, many of them young people, who make the clothes, pick the coffee, grow the genetically modified corn all around the world. I'm going to end on a bit of a cautionary note. It's easy to be seduced by these success stories, to believe, as Harvard business professor Deborah Spahr has suggested, that what we are now seeing is a spotlight phenomenon. She calls it a spotlight phenomenon. And she says it's so effective that corporations are now being shamed into ethical activity, that the embarrassment of being exposed, what happened to Nike, what happened to McDonald's, is such a strong deterrent that essentially the problem is solved. Isn't that convenient? She says that ethics are now a third bottom line. And the trendy thing is now for brand managers, a man named Scott Bedbury, who coined the Just Do It slogan for Nike, left, went to Starbucks, and coined the third place community thing for them. He's now writing a book. And he says that the internet is a truth serum for brands. The idea is that now we'll all just tell each other. We'll tell each other when brands aren't living up to their stories, their mythologies, and all will be well. The truth, however, is that these victories are haphazard and piecemeal, when they are victories at all. The real success story is not in a corporate ethical epiphany, an alleged corporate epiphany. The real success story is the success of organizing and education that has put these issues on the agenda. And that's why Seattle was so significant, because it was the next step. Making the bridge from the single-issue corporate campaigns to a broader, more structural critique of the regulatory bodies that are playing referee in this race to the bottom. So what these campaigns are really about is not a battle over which brand is more ethical, but rather they are about a classic power struggle, a struggle over who is going to write the rules for the global economy. Will it be the citizens and workers and their democratic institutions, perhaps institutions that do not yet exist? Or will it be the corporations and their unaccountable trade organizations? I think that we are at the very early stages of imagining a kind of global New Deal, which has as its foundation the need for enforceable regulations governing labor, environmental, and human rights in the global economy. The need to rein in corporate power on the global level so that corporations are ruled by citizens rather than the other way around. Thank you.